Informed Dissent, brought to you by Firearm Training Associates.
Firearms Training Associates is a lucky company because we have been able to draft in some of the best instructors in the world. We have special operations guys. We have guys from the U.S. military, from foreign militaries that work for us. They provide a great deal of insight into self-defense. So we developed this so that our customers could come on the weekends and get the best training in the world. We pride ourselves on our civilian training. It's our armed civilian that's one of the most important things to us. We want to teach them how to survive dangerous situations. When you come through the course, as long as you're performing at a acceptable level, you're going to get a certificate that puts our stamp on it. And we take it serious when we put our stamp on there. When you get our gold label, that means that you've passed the class that you've attended.
Firearm Training Associates, proud sponsor of Informed Dissent. Find out more at ftatv.com.
Informed Dissent. The intersection of healthcare and politics with Dr. Jeff Barkey and Dr. Mark McDonald.
Mark, welcome to another episode of Informed Dissent. Great to be with you.
Hi, Jeff.
So we don't often have recurrent guests, but this is our favorite guest. I think this is, gosh, I've lost count, number five, maybe?
No, but I'm the number one guest, Jeff.
You are the number one guest and one of the only, very few that has been on more than once. And I think this is number five. I've lost track. Number six, perhaps. And that is, of course, the great Peter McCullough, who is a physician, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and has been arguably one of the most prominent physicians on the forefront in this medical freedom battle during the entire pandemic. So, Peter, welcome back to Informed Dissent.
Thanks for having me. You know, I feel like one of the guests on Gutfield. You know,
Gutfield. On the five.
I feel like the guy who's kind of slumped in the chair with all the tattoos and the fighter belt on. Frequent guest on Informed Dissent. But do have some important updates on the legal front. The American Board of Internal Medicine was in the process of stripping me for non-clinical reasons, actually political reasons. And I was informed that my appeal on the decision to remove my certifications was indefinitely postponed. So I don't know what that means, but we were trying to, in a sense, negotiate dates for the appeal. And so now I'm in, you know, never land. I haven't been exonerated at all. The other update is that the health system that was suing me for allegedly using their name in the media. The case was dismissed after it went into mediation. There wasn't any meaningful progress on the case. There certainly wasn't any evidence that I had violated my separation agreement. So that was dropped with prejudice, means that it can't be revisited in any way. Those are the good news. The bad news is I've been fired from my second job for no reason, after being a top cardiologist at my medical center now for 10 years. So I'm picking up my bags and moving my practice 30 miles north of Dallas to McKinney. And I'll be an embedded unit within a family practice. Brian Proctor, who I've done research before on early treatment of COVID, has a nice area in cardiology. But I'm moving into completely cash practice. I'm actually disenrolling from all the insurance plans and Medicare.
Well, that is something. And, you know, Peter, the American Board of Internal Medicine, there is a whole network of these board certification organizations, including in my field, the American Board of Family Practice, that I chose several years ago to completely drop because their recertification process was a sham. It was all about money. It had nothing to do with clinical practice. And instead, I joined the Board of American Physicians and Surgeons, which is now being accepted by more and more healthcare systems. And they, you know, basically do it right. You're required to get a certain amount of CME and things that actually make sense clinically, not politically. And I hope more specialists and other board certified physicians start looking elsewhere, because I think these board certification organizations are really turning political, not clinical, and they no longer serve the practice of medicine.
It's true. Leading family doctor Scott Jensen in Minnesota, former state senator, he's being pursued now at the state board level for this is now multiple time pursuit, and it's all for non-clinical reasons. And I actually looked up the scope of his medical board as mine. The scope of medical boards is simply quality of care, deals with physician issues of substance abuse, alcohol, other things, but doesn't have any political agenda. What these boards have done is they've taken on COVID-19 community care and then COVID-19 statements, and then made that part of their mission and used that to prosecute doctors. Unprecedented in the last few years. But I understand that you have a good update on California AB 2098.
Yeah, before I move to that, I want to make one more comment about this. It's such an interesting subject with the boards, because I have personal experience of what you're describing, Peter. I just re-upped my board certification for adult psychiatry, which is sponsored by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, called ABPN, which has an office in Chicago. And the man who runs it has been accused for years now of financial improprieties, of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars for a sort of fake salary where he does nothing, from these, you know, poor psychiatrists that are trying to just keep their board certifications active. It's thousands of dollars to get this recertification. And I was given the option of either taking an exam or completing journal articles and then answering questions. I chose the latter because I thought, well, it'll just be easier and I might learn something from it. Well, I want to mention to all of our listeners out there that for the first time, and this is a board certification process that only is required every 10 years. So I did it once when I was in training, and now I'm doing it for the first time as a non-trainee. And the first time that you have to do, or given the option of doing, journal article certification. Well, this past year, I had to read journal articles and answer questions on the subject of gender equity. Gender equity. And there were multiple articles on topics like this. Transgender equity, gay rights equity, the use of proper use of pronouns when addressing patients. And these were so-called or pseudo journal articles, research articles. And if you didn't answer the questions, and I say in quotes, correctly, you were failed in receiving credit for having studied and read that article. So it is nothing other than political indoctrination. There is no other way to describe it. And I know that this is true across multiple boards. It's not just ABP, and obviously the cardiology boards, internal medicine boards, family practice boards, they've all been corrupted. And I know many physicians like Jeff, Taryn Clark, for example, a friend and colleague of ours, who's a neurologist in Orange County, decided not to renew her boards last year for the same reason that Jeff didn't. So we have a huge problem right now with the board certification process and the alternative board pathway, just like alternative hospitals and clinics and CMEs and CEUs that all of our, you know, all of us as physicians have to follow, really needs to be pushed even harder.
It's there, Mark. It's been around now for about 8 to 10 years. It's called the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. The National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. And it's open to all specialties. That's now my board certification. I dropped the American Academy of Family Practice. All the doctors in my office have done the same. I have other colleagues that are doing the same. It's just a more humane, straightforward clinical board, not a political board. And I think it's, fortunately, as far as board certification goes, there's a clear parallel alternative in the practice of medicine and insurance groups. It's coming down the pike, but it's not quite there. So there are primary care physicians that are direct primary care. They bypass insurance. You pay the doctor directly. Simone Gold, of course, is creating an organization called Gold Care. Same concept. And I think we're going to see more and more of this as patients are disgusted by the insurance products that are available, where the money goes to the insurance companies, not to the physicians and the actual providers of care. And I think market forces are causing this parallel system to be created.
Yeah, but one, I'd say one proviso on that, Jeff, is my arrangement is, laboratories, I think, are billed to insurance, echocardiography, ultrasound. It's really just the physician fee. I'll be more attorney. I'll be billing, and then there'll be a cash payment for that, which is fine by me. But the patients don't have to be worried about a big hospital bill or a big lab bill. That's covered by insurance. The National Board of Physicians and Surgeons, my only reservation is that, the leader of that is Paul Tierstein, interventional cardiologist at Scripps, and he's partners with Eric Topol. Eric Topol's the former chairman at the Cleveland Clinic. He was dismissed in disgrace because of a conflict of interest with Genentech. We're getting stock shares for giving TPA instead of doing primary angioplasty. He went to Scripps Clinic. And Eric Topol, if you notice on Twitter, is one of the biggest vaccine promoters. So I've been very concerned that this board is going to come under the dark side of vaccination. One place to look, I've learned a lot from this, is the COVID Community Core. If you go to the website, We Can Do This, that was the Biden administration and HHS launched the COVID Community Core in the spring of 2021. In total, with the disbursements, I believe it's over $13 billion of unaccounted money flowed from the federal government to a variety of organizations. And, this is federal money. That opens it up for freedom of information. If you look at the American Medical Association, the pediatric colleges, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. One of the pediatric colleges was quite interesting because someone who's a member asked the question, where did the money go? And saw one of the statements, one of the annual statements of this organization. And it turned out that the retirement accounts for all the 8 or so staff that work, as primary employees of the organization, skyrocketed to the millions each. So the money came, and it really could be used for any reason. I've been very worried about ACOG, Obstetrics and Gynecology, since that's such a strong college, and how the obstetricians came into full force supporting the vaccines with no assurances on safety and actually great mechanistic concerns and now clinical concerns. And there's a whole series of nothing short of fraudulent papers in the literature stating that the vaccines are safe in pregnant women. And how the papers are done is the papers never have 9 months of follow-up, so they never observe women for a term. They're typically cross-sectional data, so they maybe have a month or two of data. They actually don't look for the outcomes of interest, so if they don't see it, they don't report it, and they just kind of conclude that they're fine if they take the vaccine. So a lead maternal fetal medicine doctor, James Thorpe, has all the data available on this and is exposing this, that there's roughly a tenfold increased risk of fetal loss in the first trimester, similar to that of stillbirth, though stillbirth is much less common at 20 weeks. And then this terrible fetal hemorrhagic syndrome that he's seen. Thorpe showed me some pictures of this. It looks awful as the babies are born and are really in trouble. It makes sense because the spike protein is damaging to the placenta, the blood vessels, causes clotting and bleeding. There would be almost no way a baby could escape from this without some type of difficulty. Now, having said that, many couples are getting pregnant successfully and they're having babies successfully, as is many people take the vaccines are fine, roughly 85%. The leading theory here is that the vaccines some have a very low concentration of messenger RNA since they don't undergo any inspections for what's in the vials in terms of quality, purity, quantity under EUA. No inspections whatsoever. Some must have very low amount of genetic material and nothing really seems to happen. And then some are super loaded. There's now lot analyses done. The CDC has just done one. They found the same thing. About 30% of deaths from Pfizer, 80% of deaths occur from 30% of lots. 80% of Moderna deaths occur from 20% of lots. So there's what's called hot lots. People can look it up on the internet. There may be other factors. I just interviewed Marc Giadot, who's an engineer scientist from France. And he believes that some people, when they get an injection, since the nurses don't aspirate to see if they're in a small capillary or venule, that in fact they get a mainline injection of lipid nanoparticles. Others get a depot in the deltoid muscle. And he's actually studied this. About 2.5% actually get a mainline. So if you add this in, plus who gets a higher quantity, it would explain the CDC VSafe data, which is 7 to 8% of people are so sick after the shots, they have to go to the ER and be hospitalized within a few days.
Wow. So people that do well are lucky.
Well, it's basically human error and manufacturing error in the grace of God, and they do fine. But we do believe, and Giardot has published on this, that's a Russian roulette. Each time that a shot is taken, that people can do fine on shot one and shot two, then that third shot comes. And that one could be fatal. One of the first people to take a bivalent booster in Canada, in Saskatoon, was a nurse, and she was on shot three or four, and she took the bivalent. She was texting her daughter in the waiting area of the Boots Pharmacy, and boy, that was the last text she ever sent. She went into cardiac arrest, and that's it.
Peter, is there anybody in your estimation that should receive the COVID vaccine?
No, no one at this point in time. On December 7th, 2022, on the U.S. Senate floor, I called for all of them to be removed from the market, and I was very serious about that. That was followed by Andrew Brigden in the U.K. Parliament, called for full removal. Prashnath Bushnan in the India Supreme Court, I just visited him, by the way, in Delhi, and confirmed this. He had called for removal. And then Malcolm Roberts, Gerald Rennick, Ralph Babbitt in the Australian Parliament, the same thing. So we have worldwide calls that are cohesive all over the world saying, pull the vaccines off the market. I don't think there's anyone who benefits at this point in time.
Is there any other example that you can think of where we have injected a product into a human asking its machinery to create a non-human protein?
Never. And you know what's more disturbing is Moderna has about four dozen of these products in production now. So they're planning to have human cells express, for instance, the hemagglutinase of Haemophilus influenza, or the prefusion protein of respiratory syncytial virus. I don't see any way that a human cell can express a foreign protein without inciting an autoimmune attack. And I collaborated with Dr. Panagis Polygritis, a Greek scientist in Italy, and he agrees in his experiments 100% of the time the cells will invoke an autoimmune attack. I can't imagine, for instance, let's say a child 10 years from now on a pediatric schedule where that child's body is expressing, let's say, four dozen different foreign antigens on the cell surface. I can't imagine how that body would be rocked biologically.
Does your experience during the last couple, 3 years with this COVID-19 experience cause doubt in the other vaccines that we have on the market?
It has. You know, I have said that at this point in time, we just need a review of all the vaccines. Now, you know, I'm not anti-vax. I had previously taken all the vaccines. I went to India. I took more vaccines. My wife took the vaccines. My kids did. But I have to tell you, I'll be honest, Jeff, I didn't critically appraise them. I didn't critically look at them. People said, take the vaccine. I took the vaccine. And, you know, so I'll give you an easy critical appraisal. In a paper by Chung and colleagues, MMWR last year, the influenza vaccine was statistically insignificant from zero in terms of vaccine efficacy. Did nothing. Wait, why take a flu shot if it does absolutely nothing for the human body in protecting H flu? I'll give you another one. Pneumococcal vaccine, 13-valent pneumococcal. I remember in medicine clinic, we pushed this. It's calculated vaccine efficacy for protection against hospitalization and death, 9%. Statistically insignificant from zero. So some of these vaccines don't do anything. And then you can kind of go through the other ones. It's kind of interesting, you know, diphtheria and pertussis. They were a big deal, you know, decades ago. But you know, they're treated with a Z-Pack. How many kids take azithromycin? I mean, I would never take a vaccine for somebody just to treat with a Z-Pack. Tetanus. People get, you know, wound infections. We clean them out. We use antibiotics, so that's covered. If you look at measles and mumps, there have been outbreaks, you know, in recent years. Every single outbreak is among the fully vaccinated. So it's not like the vaccine. So if mumps does come into a community, the vaccine doesn't seem to stop it. The vaccines that could be compelling, I think, are rubella. Rubella, you know, we used to have 20,000 cases of rubella syndrome per year. Now we're down to one or two, maybe. And there, you know, the key target is pre-pregnancy or pre-menstruating girls. They would be ideal for the rubella vaccine. But what we do in the United States is we blanket everybody. So we even vaccinate boys who don't clinically actually have the syndrome. It's so mild, it's less than common cold. So I think for all the vaccines, we can start to move to targeting. I think rubella is compelling. Polio, I want to take a careful look at, because so many other claims on polio exist, including sanitation and insecticides and other determinants. And I think we have to kind of go through the vaccine schedule. I was struck by a recent Kaiser family survey showing that among adults now, about a third of parents, because of this COVID debacle in the vaccines, a third of parents are saying they're going to go natural with their kids, no pediatric vaccinations.
Well, I'm seeing that more and more in my practice. I have a brand new baby in my practice that just came in this past week, 6 weeks old now, cute little girl named Reagan. And the parents refused vaccination in the hospital, and I asked which ones. And it was hepatitis B. And you question, why are they giving a brand newborn baby hepatitis B? It's a sexually transmitted disease. This kid is not at risk of it. And I looked at the package insert for this vaccine, and it contains about 200 micrograms of aluminum. And so why are we injecting aluminum into a brand newborn against an illness that this kid isn't even at risk? And if you do some of the research, it never used to be this way. And what happened was so many parents were refusing these vaccines that they decided to bring them in-house in the hospitals to give them there because they had a captive audience. In this particular case, mom had a C-section. You know, she's sitting there in pain. She's struggling, trying to breastfeed, take care of her baby. The nurse comes in and basically tries to bully her into giving vaccines as if it's the right thing to do and you're a bad mom if you don't. And she politely said, no, thank you. I'll take it up with my pediatrician, or in this case, family doc. And I'm seeing more and more parents that are just saying, I don't know that I want to vaccinate my kid. And if I do, I want to do it very, very slowly, one vaccine at a time, wait and watch, make sure they do okay before we move on to the next one. You know, in the mid-1980s, by the time you're 18, you got something like 12 different shots. Now, by the time you're 18, you've got about 70 shots that we put into your arm. I'm just not sure that's good for the immune system and is healthy for the children.
Yeah, you hit some important concepts. One is vaccines could be targeted. So for instance, you know, a baby born to an active IV drug abusing mother, it may be appropriate to give a hepatitis B vaccine, try to prevent vertical transmission. But for all other children, they could actually forego hepatitis B. And then if they go into healthcare, like become a cardiologist like me or a surgeon, and they're, you know, dealing with blood and body fluids, then take the hepatitis B vaccine. So it could be appropriate and targeted for the individual, as opposed to blanketing. The other thing you said I think is really important is this idea of giving multiple vaccines at the same time. You know, recently there was a VAERS report that caught my eye. It was about a one-year-old baby in the same setting received the Tdap, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, the influenza vaccine, the pneumococcal vaccine, and then the COVID-19 vaccine. Well, that child died a few days later. And what I've been saying is that's what I call vaccinated to death. And when you look at that, you know, it's probably the intensity. Vaccines may not be so bad if they're more spread out. Remember Andrew Wakefield, who brought forward this issue with the CDC and the ICANN network, which was born out of this. Their main issue was not against vaccines. They were saying, listen, let's just space them out. Let's try to analyze this really intensive schedule versus a more relaxed schedule, and that maybe it's too much. You mentioned the adjuvants. Aluminum is an adjuvant that I think people are worried about. We used to use aluminum, by the way, in nephrology. We used to use AluCaps, aluminum phosphate binders, and it caused a neurotoxicity. And the thought is, you know, if you had a little of aluminum, probably your body manages it. But if you load it up and administration is high enough, it may achieve CNS concentrations. The other thing that's very, very simple is that when children take multiple vaccines at once, the chances of a febrile seizure go way up. And these febrile seizures are not benign. Sometimes they're the kickoff towards neuropsychiatric syndromes like autism spectrum disorder.
If we remove the vaccine conversation and just think about any other field of medicine, you know, I take care of a whole range of things from diabetes to hypertension and so forth. And I had a conversation with a guy about treating his hypertension. I said, listen, you know, a lot of people, most people, that require medication for hypertension end up needing to be on more than one medicine. So we're going to take it really slow. We're going to start with one medication, see how you do, slowly raise the dose. He made some comment along the way, well, why don't you just start me on two or three medicines if you think that's what I'm going to need? And I said, well, I don't know if that's what you're going to need, but if we use more than one product, we won't know which one you're reacting to if you have a side effect. Well, if I give MMR, DPT, and polio all at the same time, and somebody has a reaction, I don't know what they're reacting to. And we've combined all these because we've increased the number of vaccines, so we don't want a poor kid to be injected multiple times. I think that's a mistake, and I agree with you. We need to target these specifically to individuals based on their risk and not just give everything to everybody because we can. But part of it is these well child checks that were created, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, and so forth, are not designed around childhood development or my somehow unique skill to tell a mom that their kid is doing okay. It's designed around the vaccine schedule. So doctors can bill for the office visit, they can bill for the vaccines. The pharmaceutical companies that are making these vaccines are immune from all liability, and it's sort of like this vaccine industrial complex that everybody is involved with. And unfortunately, in many cases, the finances of it make it almost impossible to put the brakes on.
Well, you know, the somehow vaccines have come in the minds of humans for several decades in an intensifying cadence. And there's a belief system that our immune system is inherently weak or flawed and that we need all this support. The same type of thinking, by the way, occurs in veterinary medicine, where there's more and more vaccines for pets out there. And I think what really blew it for me in terms of losing trust is when the ACIP, that's the panel that decides the vaccine schedule, when they added the EUA COVID-19 vaccines to the panel. So if they think that these are medically necessary, clinically indicated, and actually work and are safe in children under EUA, EUA by its nature is temporary, that they have installed these in the permanent schedule, I think that was a bridge too far, and it's a broken trust. And more, if I was a young parent today, I would probably go natural with my kids, or I would be selective, just like we've discussed today. I think all the young people are going to have to face this right now and going forward. Something, you know, I've been very impressed with the data by Paul Thomas. I don't know if he's come in your circles, a pediatrician in Oregon, who actually lost his license because he started to give parents freedom of choice on vaccines. He got into quite a tussle with the medical board. So he commissioned a study of his own practice. And it turns out he had thousands of young kids who were fully vaccinated, thousands that didn't take a single vaccine. And then he studied their chronic conditions that evolved over time. And it was hands down, the vaccinated kids had more asthma, more urticaria, allergic rhinitis, tympanostomy tubes, neuropsychiatric syndromes, and the unvaccinated were clearly healthier. And I think that paper is striking. You know, it was published in the American Journal of Public Health Policy and Law, and some external force forced that journal to retract it. So here we go again. It almost seems like there are powers at play that want a needle in every arm at all costs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Peter, of course, we live in California. And in California, you cannot attend a school, private or public, unless you're fully vaccinated. And there's a law now being pushed forward by the California legislature that's going to add the HPV vaccine for both males and females as part of the childhood schedule in order to enter school. And if you want another reason for more Californians to either homeschool or leave California, then move over and make more way in Texas, where my brother and father both live, where I recently obtained a medical license to practice medicine in Texas. I have friends and family there and patients now that live in Texas. And so California is just doing some crazy things that have nothing to do with science and have everything to do with politics and the finances that go along with these vaccine and pharmaceutical companies.
I had the chance to interview Dr. Jessica Petras. You may know her, Dr. Jess. She's big on social media. She was one of the doctors in California that would grant exemptions to the vaccines over the few years. And they passed a series of California AB laws, I think 276 and 277. But these laws basically effectively made it impossible to give an exemption. They said they had to have four doctors. Each doctor could only grant five exemptions. And I think the capper was in San Diego. What they did is they published a list of kids who had exemptions from the vaccines in the newspaper. and they published the doctors who granted the exemption.
Yeah, it's insane.
Violating all HIPAA, violating.
I've told my patients I won't issue an exemption simply because I don't want them registered with the state of California. I certainly don't want to come under scrutiny if I give more than 5 exemptions. And, you know, listen, Mark and I are currently involved in a lawsuit, AB, what is it, Mark, AB?
2098.
Mark, why don't you give us an update? Where are we with that lawsuit?
I wanted to make a comment. I'd like to get a word in here about this vaccine commentary. I think there's an issue that we're dancing around, and I think it needs to be stated explicitly, which is that we're all operating, or we're told to be operating under the assumption that all of these vaccines are benign. And if they were benign, then you know, the argument that there's some financial impropriety in pushing this, and it would be meaningful, but it wouldn't be earth-shattering. But the fact that they're not benign, clearly, as Peter, you gave many examples of that, and why they're not, they really need to be treated in the same category as any other medical intervention, which is a risk-benefit calculation. And this is the only area of medicine I'm aware of that has medical interventions which are not being addressed in a risk-benefit calculation. Hepatitis B is a vaccine that, as Jeff just said, is now being given routinely to infants. I didn't get hepatitis B till I was 22 years old, and I was a college student at UC Berkeley, and I was going to Japan for a year as an exchange student, and it was required to go to Japan because Japan has a lot of hepatitis B, and it can be spread with blood transfusions or leaking blood, as well as sex. And they didn't feel that it was safe for students to go there without the vaccine. And I looked at it, and I looked at the risks and benefits, and I discovered it's probably a good thing for me to take. But I didn't get it as an infant, and it was only one. It was one shot. I didn't get anything else. And it was a long process of information and informed consent. That's completely gone now. So things have really shifted in the last 10 or 20 years. And I think that it would be critical for parents and doctors all to understand and agree that vaccines are not benign and they need to be looked at just like every other medical intervention. That's a thought that I was having as you were talking. But as far as the legal process goes, and the updates on AB 2098, I think it's, and in fact, it's interesting, Peter, you came on earlier and congratulated Jeff and I on our win against AB 2098 and the injunction that was applied for the medical misinformation bill. But we can't really take credit for that because it was actually Dr. Aaron Cariotti's class action lawsuit. He's a former psychiatrist from UC Irvine and the former head of the bioethics committee, which is ironic because he was essentially removed from his position as chairman of the biomedical ethics committee at UC Irvine because he questioned the legitimacy, the ethics of forcing all of the students and faculty to take this injection. It's like a Babylon Bee article. So he filed a lawsuit with a class of physicians in non-federal court, but just Superior Court in California. And he won an injunction for his class against the implementation of AB 2098, the medical misinformation bill. Unfortunately, it does not extend to all physicians in the state of California, only to his class. But, and I said this earlier when before we were recording, interestingly, the day that he won the injunction, I had a letter typed up and mailed to me by the California Medical Board announcing that the investigation against me for spreading medical information had been closed. So it had political ramifications, even if it didn't have widespread legal ramifications. And that's, I think, an important point for everyone that's listening to understand that there's multiple parties fighting in the same direction, different lawsuits against the same target, kind of like magnifying glasses, all being focused on the same area. And you only need one to get a win. So we might not win 100% of the time, but if we've got 5 or 6 people fighting the same battle and one of them wins, then it's really a win for all of us. And this is a political battle. And people who are pushing for shots, pushing for censorship, they respond to political pressure. And you can extend political pressure through the court system now because the courts are political tools and political weapons. And I think a lot of us are starting to realize that, and we're starting to use the courts, The same way that the left has been using the courts for a long time, people on the what I've called the reality side, the conservative side, are starting to use them as well to achieve good and just political aims. And I support that. I really believe that one of the reasons why people who are, I think, honest and ethical have been losing these battles up until recently is that we have not understood and accepted that the game has changed. Just like these so-called, you know, vaccines and real vaccines have been shifted and pushed in different directions unethically in the last few years, so have a lot of the legal processes. And I think that the realists among us who understand that are now starting to wise up, just like some Republicans now are starting to move towards ballot harvesting, which is what has been done for a lot of time, many years, for the Democrats.
Yeah, yeah.
So big message here is that we need to get on board with fighting the real fight.
Yeah, I'll give you another working example of fighting the fight that was effective. Is I've on two occasions I've testified in the Texas Senate by invitation for the Health and Human Services Committee, but on June 27th of 2022, I testified. And in my prepared remarks, I lectured the committee about community standard of care. What is a community standard of care? That doctors and healthcare providers, we establish the community standard of care based on what we find useful in diagnosing and treating patients. And we incorporate information from the literature and patient, you know, our own practice experience. But we define the community standard of care. It's never defined by federal agencies or by medical boards. And, you know, I explained, listen, if a doctor used hydroxychloroquine, that's the community standard of care. The very first doctor who treated, but that is the community standard of care. And after I got made my points come across, within 2 days, doctors received letters on all these medical board investigations saying, you met the community standard of care. Your case is dismissed. And one of them just said, I want to frame this letter. And so what we've found ourselves as practicing doctors, our lives were perfectly happy and normal for this. We've had to become legal and healthcare, public health advocates, public figures. We've had to be freedom fighters. Our lives have been cast in some new direction now, and it seems like there's some new twist or turn all the way around. And sometimes we think we get victories, and we don't. It seems like we're battling some type of force that really, from a clinical and medical biological perspective, doesn't make sense. You know, Moderna's saying, you know, 40 messenger RNA products. Well, COVID-19 vaccines, as the first messenger RNA product in clinical use, have been a disaster. I mean, the last thing you do is load up a lot more. And then the FDA granting a fast track designation for the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. Fast track, like, as if this is some type of urgency. So we have a lot of things going on. I recently just talked to Lucia Sinatra, who heads up a nonprofit organization called No College Mandates. And boy, she knows everything about college mandates. I learned that 1,000 colleges and universities still have mandates, many of them institutions that, you know, accept federal funds for research. Many of them have the mandates for the students, but not for faculty, even though the faculty would be older and be at risk for the condition. They don't seem to have any concerns or apologies for students who develop myocarditis, blood clots, or those who die. No concerns whatsoever. And interestingly, no one knows who at the university is responsible for the mandate, who actually made the decision. No one knows. No one knows. It's so interesting. Same thing in big corporate America. I've asked countless patients, who at your company decided to have the mandate? Oh, we don't know. I talked to a woman last night, different topic, but she's a mother and she's very concerned about pornographic material in school for, you know, elementary and junior high students. And she was describing all this horrific things she discovered in these textbooks. I said, who is responsible for onboarding these textbooks and approving? No one knows. No one knows. No one seems to know. Or I can tell you this much. If there was a new campaign at a university to raise $5 million, there'd be someone responsible. if someone won a prize or there was some good deed that went, someone would be the first one in the news. No one's in the news saying, I am responsible for this man.
Right. This Lucia Sinatra, wow. Is she a physician?
No, it turns out she's an attorney.
Interesting.
You guys should interview her. She's really...
Yeah, if you could get Beth her contact information, I'd love to talk to her and get involved in her organization. I have so many kids in my practice that they're struggling with the mandates going off to college in various states. The parents don't want them to get vaccinated. The kids kind of want to get vaccinated because they want to go away to college. And most of these colleges will not accept a religious exemption. And it's not right. It's just not right to mandate a kid of all people to get a vaccine that they don't need.
Well, you know, here's another thing. We got into the psychology of this. Remember the history of college kids. They have sit-ins. They have smokeouts. They have protests. They're going to protest the Vietnam War. They've protested everything. On this, there's almost no protest. The only protest I remember is at Indiana University. That case ultimately was dismissed by the Supreme Court. The kids don't seem to mind this. When children die, the parents don't seem particularly upset. They don't go into a fit of rage and raise, you know, all this awareness. Nowadays, listen, three students were just shot at Michigan State University. Oh my gosh, that was all over the news. People are all over this. If people wanted to raise a ruckus about these vaccine deaths, they could. We're not seeing this anywhere. The families are amazingly quiet. They just seem to accept this. The kids accept it. The friends and siblings accept it.
Selective outrage.
Donald, why is this?
I asked Lucia, I said, are we more concerned about these kids and these families than they are? She goes, yeah. She said, yeah, we're actually more concerned and disturbed than they are.
Mark, what's your take on this? Peter brings up
an excellent point, and I think it has to do with selective indoctrination outrage. Professors are being fired for refusing to give every single student an A grade in their class or requiring students to attend exams in person. They're being fired. They're being driven out because the students have protested. And the administration has caved instantaneously to their protests. Why are they protesting for entitlement and comfort? And they're being granted every single wish, but they're not even speaking up against a foreign body being injected inside of them that could kill them. Complete silence. It's a really interesting question. I believe it's because they have been activated to be professional ideological protesters under specific flags and specific causes, while they have been indoctrinated in the opposite direction for causes that really do matter. So this has been, once again, an enormous cultural shift, just like we mentioned the shift away from selective risk-benefit profiles in vaccines 20, 30 years ago when we were growing up, to today where it's just considered automatic. Same thing with protests and causes. This is a bigger issue. This is not a medical issue. This is not even academic freedom. This is, I think, a macro level issue that Peter's bringing up about society and about the power of completely changing the way of thought among a younger generation using a very sophisticated and complex AI-driven and corporate and bureaucratically driven algorithm through social media and the control of information that we've never seen before in previous generations. In a short period of time, we could be, potentially with ChatGPT and AI infiltrating all of our information systems, we could be seeing deep fakes that are so specific and so sophisticated that it will be impossible to be able to differentiate between fake news and real news. Absolutely impossible. And if we get to that point, you're going to see a whole cohort of young people who never went into a library to read a book. They never grew up without an internet. They're going to be believing and accepting reality as told to them by their phone. Literally, that will become their reality. And if that happens, we will have lost the ability to actually raise a generation of Americans who can even think for themselves. And that terrifies me.
So on that positive note, you know, Mark and I interviewed Paul Alexander, who's from the Caribbean, I think Trinidad, and we're going to move in with his parents, I think, in some Caribbean island and escape.
I saw Paul's post. Him and Harvey Risch were at Mar-a-Lago. So what is the scoop? Did Paul actually talk with Trump about the vaccines?
Well, I know Trump, Paul worked at HHS and had an audience with Trump many times in the White House, and he was very concerned about the information that Trump was getting and believing, and the overt and covert threats that if Fauci and Brix and so forth were exposed, that they would leak to the media that they were being silenced. And so Paul did acknowledge that both the DeSantis campaign, Trump campaign, and others have been reaching out to him for medical and scientific guidance. And I hope that's the case.
I hope so. I just can't imagine that an information filter like this, I mean, there's so much out there on vaccine deaths and myocarditis. I mean, just, you know, the peer-reviewed literature is overflowing. I mean, everywhere we go, we see it. Our practices are filled of cases with myocarditis, blood clots, on and on, family members, friends. I mean, it's just, you can't have a conversation, you know, in a single day without another vaccine injured person. But, you know, getting back to this idea of apathy, the idea that somehow there is a cloud of apathy and no one seems to be bothered. You know, Democratic Congressman Sean Casten from Illinois, pushing the vaccine. Everybody's got to get vaccinated. He's going to take his kids to get vaccinated. His 17-year-old daughter, Emily, perfectly healthy, takes the shot, and she dies in her sleep. And, you know, he's actually gets some investigation. The doctor said, yeah, she died of a fatal arrhythmia. You know, I can tell you as a cardiologist, that is subclinical vaccine induced myocarditis. There's death during sleep. This is well documented now. In an autopsy study by Schwab and colleagues, they examined people found dead at home after the vaccine within 20 days. They took the vaccine, they're dead. They did an autopsy. 70-80% of them had things that were clearly related to the vaccine. Another recent autopsy study by Chavez and colleagues from Columbia, same thing. So this idea of, you know, Casten would have a wonderful role to play in history, saying, listen, I made a horrible mistake. I was promoting these vaccines. I've lost my daughter. I'm heartbroken. I've got to go out and warn other people. I have to warn people. UK cardiologist Asim Malhotra, he came to that. He was promoting the vaccines. He's a young guy. He's in the media all the time. His dad, a senior doctor in the UK, takes the vaccine and dies. And he concludes he's died of an ischemic syndrome due to the vaccine. Malhotra goes on to lose his older brother, who had Down syndrome, of some type of complication and, you know, lack of access to care. Has lost his mother. So he actually has no more primary relatives. And he reached out to me over a year ago. He says, what do I do? And I said, well, you know, I think you've got to come out here. And he said, no, he goes, until I publish my own analyses, and he published two papers analyzing risk-benefit vaccines in peer-reviewed literature. Then he came out. And I looked at his journey and I said, boy, that took so much intellectual courage and so much insight. We're not seeing that in Sean Casten. You know, we're not seeing that in, look at Damar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills. I came on Tucker Carlson within 24 hours. I told Tucker, listen, he's going to make it. We had all the prognostic features for this. I said, but, you know, I would ask the question, did he take the vaccine? Because the vaccine is the leading cause of myocarditis. And if athletes exercise with myocarditis, it triggers sudden death. And to this day, we're almost 2 months into it. Hamlin interviews with Michael Strahan. And Strahan asks him, hey, what caused the cardiac arrest? Hamlin says, I don't want to go there.
Yeah, someone got to him.
Yeah, we know where he wanted to go. And it's ridiculous that we can't talk openly about this.
Well, I've pushed in the media. Now, there's been a recent news reports that there's going to be ICD codes, that people are going to have ICD various status. I said, listen, we need ICD codes for all the vaccine injuries, like, vaccine-induced retinal blindness and optic nerve blindness and blood clots and all the syndromes. There's dozens and dozens of syndromes. I said, but what we really need is doctors need access to that CDC vaccine administration record. We need to know who took these vaccines, because in the setting of emergency, we have to know. It influences our decision-making. I can tell you in cardiology for sure with the thrombosis, I need to know. Right now, the CDC is keeping that a secret. The other thing that needs to happen in the United States and all countries, there needs to be a merge of the CDC vaccine administration records and the National Death Index, because we see see increases in all-cause mortality across all the countries, we have to know, is it in temporal proximal relationship to the vaccine? So the government holds all the data. We don't have to codify things as doctors. The government has all this.
Well, you know, Peter, they do have an ICD code. And for those listening, it's the coding mechanism that we use to give a number to a diagnosis that's for insurance billing purposes and statistical purposes. So there's an ICD-10, that's the latest coding data, for unvaccinated patients. So people that refuse the vaccine, they have created an ICD-10 code and are asking physicians to code for that when you see a patient so they can track data on patients who have refused the vaccination.
But Jeff, why would they do that? The CDC already knows. The CDC, you know, they have all the data. They know who took the vaccine. They have all the U.S. Census data. Every person's known. So that's already known. So why would we need to codify that?
I don't know.
To deny people insurance.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I can think of.
We've been going now for about an hour, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. You're a couple hours ahead of us in Texas, and I think I can hear your wife screaming in the background. It's time to come to bed.
I want to ask you one question, though. You went to Australia recently. How did they let you in?
You know, it was an amazing time. First, we went to India. I went with Asim Malhotra and bestselling author John Leake, and we had a great symposium there. We met Prashant Bhushan, a fearless barrister who argued in the Supreme Court of India that the vaccine mandates were unconstitutional, and he won. The Indians were fairly open with this. They had estimated a third of the country had fake vaccine cards. They said, listen, this isn't, you know, we don't care. This isn't. And I've heard that across Eastern Europe, that these programs aren't going anywhere. People are just going to get fake cards anyway. But
Australia's been really, really harsh about letting people in. And Dr. Chris Martinick, who's been corresponding with me for a while, and he sent me a picture of him standing next to you in Sydney at the conference that you went to with John Leake and from Wisconsin.
Pierre Corey.
Pierre Corey, thank you.
Let me tell you.
Yeah. How did you guys get in?
Let me tell you the backstory. So we apply for, so it turns out that I had a visa from before. I was a visiting professor, so I already had a visa. I didn't remember I had one, but I had to apply for my wife, and she got one. John Leake, the author, he got one. But they blocked Pierre Corey to the very end, and finally it took some action in Parliament. So on midnight, the night before his visa, they literally had to buy plane tickets for him within 3 hours for him to start, you know, getting to Australia. I had an existing visa, but they flagged us coming in. So as soon as I came in, went, you know, and they said, come over here. And they pulled me over. They said, you're on the wrong visa. This and that.
Wow.
They tried to kind of rough us up a little bit. But we were able to get in. Now, once we got in, it was amazing. There were huge programs, huge. Thousands of people showed up. This was like, it was like a rock concert.
I saw the photos. It was sold out. It was amazing.
It was unbelievable. We were guests of Clive Palmer, who is, he is, I think, the sixth wealthiest Australian. And he was a wonderful host. He arranged these venues. And, we got the message out. And the real heroine of the whole program is a woman named Melissa McCann. She's a doctor in Australia who's had this dialogue with the head of their TGA, which is like the head of our FDA. And she did a practice audit. She's a general practitioner doctor and she basically, in a series of letters, has John Skerritt, who's the head of the TGA, admitting that there's fatal vaccine-induced myocarditis in these reports. And what he's admitted to is it's not released to the public because he doesn't want to cause vaccine hesitancy. So she has him nailed on a cover-up. And so this was all exposed. This was the opening lecture. And so this is, and she talked about there, you know, you have these laws, they get what's called decertified. They've actually decertified 500 doctors because they've just said one word out of line regarding the vaccine.
Amazing.
That's insane. That's insane.
Wow.
Well, thank you for spreading the word of freedom around the world, for sure. And we appreciate your voice. And Peter, it's always an honor to have you on, the number one guest on Informed Dissent. So thank you again.
You can follow me on my website, petermcculloughmd.com. and you can get everywhere on the internet. We're going to leave it there, guys. Thank you so much.
You got it. Thank you, Peter.
You've been listening to Informed Dissent with Dr. Jeff Barkey, board-certified primary care physician, and Dr. Mark McDonald, board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. Informed Dissent, the intersection of healthcare and politics.